Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney with the club's Leadership and Business Forum, and your host for today's program, which is entitled Quantitative Easing, Re-Leveraging of a Nation. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Patrick Yam. Patrick Yam is the CEO of Sensei Partners LLC, an early-stage Menlo Park-based private investment firm. His 25-year career includes responsibilities as macroeconomist, financial and technology executive, and institutional investor with significant experience in company building, investment banking, investment management, and venture capital. He has been associated with the Federal Reserve Bank, Lehman Brothers, Citicorp Investment Bank, and Matthews International Management. A published author, he teaches and lectures on entrepreneurship in Santa Clara University's Lucas School, where he's Dean's Executive Professor of Entrepreneurship and a former faculty member of the Venture Capital Institute. He's associated with UC Santa Barbara, and he is a senior advisor to the think tank Beacon Economics. Patrick?
Thank you. Thanks, Elizabeth. Thank you and Gloria Duffy and George Dobbins and all your colleagues for providing this fine open forum, the Commonwealth Club. I've often given this speech at various ports throughout the world. It's, you know what? It's great to be home in San Francisco, and especially here at Commonwealth Club. Hi, I'm Patrick Yam. I'm here today to address the current monetary policy implemented by the Federal Reserve with significant domestic economic impact and global consequence. Through technology, we benefit today from exposure to receiving news from various mediums. Nevertheless, we suffer along with benefiting from receiving sound bites and snippets with disparate viewpoints, which often accentuates our confusion, inability to interpret it the entirety of any subject, and in this instance, quantitative easing. A few mechanics before we get going. Confused are corporate leaders, public officials, and fellow citizens remain challenged in developing confidence and optimism, critical components for economic recovery. Currently, we are enduring the challenges of a protracted non-technical economic recession. As you can see from the aforementioned slide before you, these are epiphanal economic times. President Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, once said, with regards to the above two Chinese characters, when written in Chinese, the word crisis is composed of two characters. One represents danger, and the other represents opportunity. There are various dynamic pieces that are kinetically evolving, and it is too early to realize the full impact of quantitative easing. Nevertheless, we need to reflect on whether quantitative easing has provided the necessary support to stabilize and remedy the Great Recession. If not, what challenges remain as impediments to our economic recovery? Importantly, we need to reflect on economic consequences beyond the current phase of quantitative easing, QE2, which concludes next week. My aspiration is to provide you a greater understanding of quantitative easing through its history, economic results, as well as to address those challenges to its future success, enabling you to determine the merits and value of quantitative easing. Last October 2010, my colleagues and I at YAM Media authored a paper on quantitative easing entitled Quantitative Easing, A Curse or Blessing. At YAM Media, our intent is to provide you clarity regarding poignant economic, financial market, and innovation topics as quantitative easing. Since the publication of our paper, the global economy continues its dramatic evolution, and I'll incorporate discussion of these changes today. Before we commence, I'd like to make special attention and thanks to a few people here in this room. First off, to my two and one that's absent graduate assistants, I'd like for them to stand up. Suchit Medrotra. Secondly, Brian Yam. And thirdly, Francesca LeBaron, who unfortunately has a death in her family and cannot be with us today. And I also like to take this opportunity to make a special recognition to my mother sitting in the audience. Although I am an alum of the Federal Reserve Bank, I'm addressing you today from a nonpartisan perspective. I encourage you, your participation, and seek to answer your questions upon the conclusion of my speech. With aspiration to gain your confidence and optimism for our economy, I will commence on leading you through an odyssey to optimism through knowledge. The past few years, we've endured an economic period characterized by low inflation and a low treasury yield curve. With interbank interest rates close to zero, we've endured a liquidity trap where the Fed needed to adopt unconventional means and tools to excite economic growth. Quantitative easing is a monetary tool, one which the Federal Reserve had not used prior to 2007. Various sources define quantitative easing as an unconventional monetary policy used by some central banks to stimulate their economy when conventional monetary policy has become ineffective. A central bank creates money by buying government bonds and other financial assets in order to increase money supply and the excess reserves of the banking system. Intent on solving today's economic catharsis, the Federal Reserve became prolific investors in U.S. Treasuries. The Fed, through its prodigious monetary actions, lowered Treasury yields and decreased financing costs, hoping to incite borrowers to borrow to provide critical stimulus for economic recovery. As you can see, the graph before you, a liquid economy. These define the sources from which the Federal Reserve has access to provide the liquidity I mentioned a moment ago. Initiating quantitative easing monetary action, the Fed leveraged its balance sheet through various resources. The Fed's implementation of quantitative easing was warranted and timely. Although the Fed's adoption and implementation of quantitative easing may be new, such monetary policies have been used in Japan since 1990. First of all, my sincerest sympathy to the people of Japan for their tragedies that they've suffered since March of this year. Best wishes to them in their revitalization efforts in combating challenges that arose from their epic tsunami and earthquake disasters. The Central Bank of Japan initiated quantitative easing in 1990. with hope that it may remedy their then 10-year economic recession. Whereas we colloquially refer to the first decade of this century as the last decade, the Japanese have effectively suffered two lost decades. Decades in which their economy, investment markets, and citizenry have endured countless economic interruptions in resuscitating positive economic traction. At best, the Japanese implementation of quantitative easing is questionable, but more often characterized as ineffective. Through applying quantitative easing monetary measures, Japan has become the most levered Western economy, with debt to GDP of approximately 225%. The futility of the Japanese economic remediation efforts worsened earlier this year when Japan's sovereign debt was lowered by Standard & Poor's from AA to AA-. Such action may cause investors to shed their investment in Japanese bonds, subsequently driving yields higher, increasing cost of capital, and further dampening their hope for economic recovery. A sage Greek philosopher, Plutarch, once stated, "To make no mistakes is not in the power of man, but from their errors and mistakes, the wise and good learn wisdom for the future." I have shared Plutarch's sage wisdom with various audiences. At an earlier Commonwealth Club speech in early 2009, I addressed the economic crisis of 2008, deleveraging of a nation, where I stressed that we are entering a new economic period, one in which the historical tools for economic recovery may be unfamiliar and results enigmatic. But in implementing new monetary tools and policies, we need to be mindful of not repeating yesterday's errors. Evidently, the Japanese have not adopted Plutarch's sage advice. The ferocity of our current Great Recession and the daunting probability that systemic economic and financial risk would permeate beyond our domestic economy required the Fed to implement the first phase of quantitative easing, QE1. The Fed quickly injected $1.7 trillion into our money supply, believing that quick and decisive monetary actions would relieve protracted economic problems. Have they? I praise the Fed for quickly understanding that the magnitude of the current economic firestorm required the implementation of a new strategic monetary policy. Having exhausted most current monetary tools, the Fed adopted quantitative easing in late 2008, untested in our domestic economic history. The Fed implemented notable economic programs as TALF and TARP in purchasing Treasury securities, loans from banks, and mortgage-backed securities. Quantitative easing provided economic stability and assurance that our financial system and economy would be adequately supported while stemming systemic economic and financial risk and global contagion. In our publication, I question whether quantitative easing is a curse or a blessing. As reflected in the above slide, results to date have been negligible. My hope, unrealized as of today, is that it will not be a catalyst to heightening inflation and worse, setting a stage for stagflation, especially with today's stagnant economy. Established by Federal Charter in 1913, the Fed has two distinct mandates. The Fed is responsible through setting monetary policy to safeguard employment, and secondly, price stability or limit inflation. The latent impact of quantitative easing's economic measures will foretell whether the Fed has been successful in fulfilling its mandate. Although the immediate actions of QE1, born from necessity, quelled further damage to our economy, it has not resuscitated our economy, nor our employment fronts. Today, headline unemployment remains above 9%, and when considering those underemployed and not currently on the employment rolls, the rate is closer to 15%, nearly 23 million workers displaced. Unlike prior recessions, today's unemployed and underemployed have not been working for considerably longer. In part, today's economic recession and high unemployment is attributable to an evolution of today's workforce, as evidenced by the fact that this past year saw an increase of 2% in the employment fronts, while capital expenditures for software increased 26%. Evidently, greater productivity has been achieved through the adoption of technology, limiting the need to expand our workforce. The Federal Reserve's Principal Employment Index, JOLTS, reflects that there have been small gains in employment since implementation of QE2, or QE in general, and today the availability of job opportunities per employee are similar to those at the beginning of this Great Recession. This is an improvement when considering that from 2000 to 2007, the U.S. saw its weakest period of job creation since the Great Depression. Prolonged unemployment has increasingly waned corporate and consumer confidence and optimism, critical components for economic revitalization. Recognizing the protracted nature of the Great Recession and the latent realization of economic recovery, the Fed in November 2010 initiated the second phase of quantitative easing, QE2, which will add an incremental $600 billion to a money supply by its expiration at the end of June 2011, next week. In aggregate, quantitative easing has added $2.3 trillion, or 25% to M2, our domestic money supply. Deja vu, perhaps. Excuse me. Similar to the Japanese, we've also disregarded Plutarch's sage advice by re-engaging in the re-leveraging of our nation. Our economy exhibits leverage characteristics to that of the early to mid-2000s. Time will determine and define the efficacy of today's quantitative easing monetary actions. Certainly, detractors will challenge the magnitude of liquidity that's been added to our money supply, whereas others will support quantitative easing by defending the necessity of its implementation in stabilizing our economy in today's Great Recession. Irrespective of quantitative easing's questionable value and effectiveness, many will ask whether the Federal Reserve has been complicit in aiding the insatiable debt appetite, of our U.S. Treasury. The ballooning of our national debt and leverage ratio is more characteristic of emerging nations than that of the leading and most mature global economy. Through the incurrence of increased national debt through quantitative easing, the Fed has displaced China and Japan as a leading investor in U.S. Treasuries. Today, our national debt to GDP nears 95% and will soon exceed limits set forth by Congress. Exceeding national debt limits will further weaken our questionable longstanding professed economic philosophy of attempting to maintain a strong dollar, which has aided in enticing foreign sovereignties to invest in U.S. Treasuries. Nonetheless, our leverage ratio pales in comparison to that of the third leading global economy, Japan. Today, Japan's national debt exceeds its GDP by 225%, as I mentioned earlier. But when compared to the national debt of China, with a national leverage ratio of 19%, it is alarming. Our national debt has become the conflict du jour among our congressional lawmakers, debating its passage and further polarizing any modicum of government effectiveness on Capitol Hill. Undoubtedly, the national debt limits will be expanded. The consequences of a debt default are far too great, especially with today's fragile economy. The adverse consequence of exceeding the national debt on our economy and financial markets will be dramatic. The gravity of our excessive leverage was alarmingly brought to fore by a report in March 2011, which speculated that S&P, Standard & Poor's, was considering a downgrade of our national credit from AAA, a critical concern. With a downgrade, the yield of our Treasury notes and bonds would increase considerably. Commensurately, overall cost of financing would become more expensive, further jeopardizing our economic recovery and decreasing the effectiveness of quantitative easing measures. In a later note, our esteemed former president, Herbert Hoover, once stated, "Blessed are the young, for they shall inherit the national debt." For the sake of our progeny, I hope that we will be more astute and considerate and not limit the future economic hope and aspirations of our future leaders. The implementation of QE2 has brought our country to epic levels of national debt, further weakening the U.S. dollar. The Fed's intended objective in exercising quantitative easing to lower Treasury yields and subsequently financing costs remains questionable. An important but forgotten consideration is that even with lowered financing costs, would this excite constructive demand? Irrespective of however low bond yields and cost of financing may become, if there are impasses to the demand of borrowers to borrow, the actions of quantitative easing will be rendered moot. Accessibility to credit has impaired borrowers. Without credit, the foundation for economic growth, our economy remains fragile. Apprehension and perhaps paranoia among bank regulators of escalating the Great Recession has limited credit availability, but for gilt-edged large corporations. Accessibility to credit, but by large corporations, is benign to the fact that 85% of our domestic workforce of 153 million employees work in small and mid-market enterprises, which critically need the availability of credit more so than larger corporations. Throughout 2010, access to credit remained limited, explaining the decrease in loan demand. Year-on-year commercial bank credit decreased by 2.9%. Lending by savings institutions fell by 2.1%, and credit from non-financial institutions fell 0.9%. Limitations of credit to available credit explains in part the anemic 1.9% annualized GDP generated for first quarter 2011, far below the projected goal of attaining a 4.5% GDP for 2011. And fortunately, with the enactment of the Frank Dodd Act, the availability of credit will further tighten. Quantitative easing has weakened the U.S. dollar. As the dollar weakened, it has strengthened other sovereign currencies. A weakened dollar has benefited our export trade, which has risen 20% over the past year, reducing our trade deficit, as our capital goods and services have become cheaper relative to our trading partners, whereas the strengthening of other current sovereign currencies have made their export of capital goods costlier. The impact of quantitative easing has been chastised by our trading partners, who have challenged us with discussion of protectionistic trade barriers and measures. Through quantitative easing, we've instigated a new trade environment, that of competitive devaluation. Counteracting the impact of our quantitative easing measures, the Bank of England and the Central Bank of Europe have adopted similar monetary policies to that of the Federal Reserve. Contrary to our monetary actions, both have limited the extent of their quantitative easing measures. Whereas a weakened dollar has benefited our export sector, it has eroded the confidence of global investors in our Treasury notes and bonds. This is a critical concern when considering that recently foreign sovereignties own nearly 65% of our Treasury investments. Throughout the past decade, the proclivity of foreign investors to invest in U.S. Treasuries have acted as a formidable market force in keeping Treasury yields low and financing costs alluring. Quantitative easing has brought forth a new brinksmanship. gambling upon the proclivity of foreign investors to not divest their investments in our U.S. Treasury securities. If our allies, specifically China and Japan, significantly divest their U.S. Treasury investments, Treasury yields will rise exponentially, along with financing costs, prolonging our economic slowdown. The above slide reflects that some sovereignties have started divesting their U.S. Treasury investments. Without support of foreign investors, we are at the behest of monetary policies as quantitative easing to act as a catalyst for economic recovery. Quantitative easing has injected significant liquidity into our monetary supply through the Fed's purchase of Treasury bonds. The Fed's actions have lowered Treasury yields, specifically the 10-year Treasury bond, which have attracted large corporate issuers. Qualified issuers have access to bond market and secured extremely favorable long-term financing while promoting excessive behavior among corporate America. Among issuers, IBM raised $1.5 billion at 1%. Lowest financing coupon of the more than 3,400 securities in the Barclays Capital U.S. Corporate Index of investment-grade company debt and applied subject proceeds to repurchasing IBM stock. It's not my intent here to judge the merit of such an investment. As a CEO, I support the repurchase of Treasury stock through accessing such attractive financing. But when it may foreshadow the lack of top-line revenues and the exhaustion of cost-cutting measures, it becomes a questionable practice. Similarly, I question the application of such bond proceeds to increase dividends. My concern for both practices are that they're inorganic means to increase share price that provide an illusion to shareholders of underlying corporate growth and strength, which may not be sustainable. Quantitative easing has been a deleterious catalyst assisting in the re-leveraging of America. Aside from the excesses of the preceding financial engineering by corporations, they exercised quantitative easing measures with latent and questionable results have adversely impacted corporate and consumer confidence and optimism. Consequently, as noted earlier, demand construction weakens, loan demand erodes, and economic recovery slows. Corporate confidence and optimism remain volatile throughout 2010. Consternation among corporate leaders delayed their hiring plans. Today, industrial capacity remains at 76%, reflecting the apprehension and indecision of many corporate leaders to expand. The lack of corporate confidence and optimism is reflected on their balance sheets. Today, in aggregate, there is nearly $2.3 trillion in cash on the balance sheets of corporations, representing 6% of all corporate assets, most since 1964. Certainly, our economy will not resurrect without support and investment by the private sector and corporate captains. Confidence and optimism remains lacking among consumers as well. Consumer demand has decreased precipitously from its height of representing nearly 75% of our GDP in the mid-2000s to 71% today. In May, the Conference Board announced a drop of 10% in consumer confidence from April to an index of 60.8, slightly above the no confidence barometer of 50. Increasing dismay regarding current residential real estate, reflected by increasing foreclosures and decrease in value of 5% over the past year and over a third since 2006, has caused consumer confidence to continue waning. Until such time that a remedy is determined and applied to decrease the inventory of foreclosed homes, confidence and optimism will be difficult to restore. Consumer apprehension is reflected by their propensity to save, which has risen from negative 2% in 2007 to nearly 5% today. Aside from increasing savings, consumer apprehension was evident in the investment markets, where there was a flight to safety exhibited by consumer demand for commodities. Their interest, along with excess liquidity afforded through quantitative easing, drove the commodity markets to new heights as a flight to safety against potential inflation concerns. It's difficult to assess benefits derived from quantitative easing. If we were to report on a quantitative easing scoreboard today, it would read that employment has not improved, confidence and optimism wanes, and foreign trading partners are irritated. Well, if the benefits of quantitative easing remain questionable, has its actions, at least, aided in stabilizing the Great Recession? Today, core inflation remains below 2%. While the key inflation factor principally used by the Federal Reserve to gauge inflation, personal consumption index, which excludes food and energy, remains at a year-on-year low of 0.4%. Such a low PCE index will not excite the Fed anytime soon to recognize inflation, nor the necessity to raise interest rates. Often, we receive indications from the media regarding headline inflation, which excludes energy and food, that reflect differently from PCE. Recently, our team examined the food and energy sectors, determined the magnitude of inflationary pressure, and whether quantitative easing has been a catalyst in inciting inflation. We determined that aberrant conditions have caused inflation in both factors over the past year. Wheat, a significant factor in the global food basket, has been impacted by natural disasters, which has interrupted the supply-demand equation. Russia and Australia, two significant world providers of wheat, have been besieged by natural disasters of drought and flood of historical proportions. Earlier in June, Australia reported significant economic slowing attributable to damage caused by their floods. We believe that such disorders are aberrant, and that the price of wheat will revert to historical levels, and that sustained inflation in the global food basket is unwarranted. Energy, the other significant factor, not included in the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, has also been severely impacted by notable increases in costs, especially in the price of oil. The upsurge in the price of oil has consequently increased the cost of gas, until recently, by nearly 30% over this past year. In examining the rapid increase in the price of oil, we identified that its dramatic increase has been driven as much by speculative interest, investment behavior, than from a significant imbalance in the supply and demand equation. Another factor influencing the increase in the price of oil has been the weakness of the U.S. dollar, perhaps due to quantitative easing measures. Oil is dollar-denominated and priced to the U.S. dollar. As the U.S. dollar decreases, oil producers, in an attempt to maintain equilibrium and purchase parity, will increase the price of oil. It is reasonable to believe that as the Arab Spring matures, Middle East production of oil will return to more historical levels, and consequently the price of oil and gas should decrease from its current levels as speculative investment behavior subsides. In examining three leading determinants of inflation, we discovered that inflation today remains at manageable levels, despite recent increases. Despite the excess liquidity provided through quantitative easing, it has not significantly, to our detriment, fueled inflation. The Federal Reserve remains very deliberative and cautious in its management of inflationary pressure. Support for quantitative easing measures is comprehensible. Quantitative easing has been instrumental in stabilizing our economy. Although the benefits of injecting $2.3 trillion in excess liquidity into our economy are not readily apparent, neither are notable adverse impacts. Let's consider other global dynamics that may influence the immediate cessation or support for quantitative easing. I've often questioned, throughout this past year, the rapidity of epic global events. It's caused me to reflect on my Chinese culture, specifically in regards to the lunar calendar. Whereas this is the year of the rabbit, often 2011 has seemed more like the year of the black swan. The term black swan defines occurrence of unpredictable epic events, which often the immediate resolution of such challenges are not imminent. Notable among recent black swan events are the above factors of the Arab Spring revolutions, the Japanese natural disasters, as well as the reconstruction of the European Common Union economies. These events each present different challenges to the monetary goals of quantitative easing and independently impact both the domestic as well as global economies. Japan is a significant and yet disruptive global factor threatening our domestic economy. The extent of the Japanese natural disasters have yet to be fully determined nor realized. Japan is a significant supply-side provider, not only to the automotive, technology, but other domestic industrial sectors. Both automotive and technology sectors are recovering economic industries and significant contributors to our domestic GDP. Problems emanating from the tsunami and earthquake disasters in Japan this past March have not been fully defined nor realized. To date, the consequence of this epic disaster has been adversarial in its impact to the domestic supply chain, impacting various industries by limiting the availability of inventory and prolonging our economic recovery. Another disruptive black swan epic factor could be the economic erosion of the European Common Union economies and the unintended consequences brought forth by the PIGS, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. Whereas U.S. banks may be limited in our exposure to the current European economic troubles, it is not devoid of its interruptive impact. The ECU economic catharsis has contributed to significant volatility in the dollar, the world's global reserve currency. The volatility of the dollar has accentuated enigma and consternation in strategic planning by our corporate leaders, which has eroded their confidence and optimism, further prolonging our economic recovery. Preceding black swans each provide different challenges to our domestic economy. The troubling continuance of the Arab Spring exerts pricing pressures on the price of oil and consequently that of gas. The Japanese disaster may cause the Japanese to repatriate their U.S. Treasury investments for rebuilding of their economy. And further erosion of the European Common Union economies will independently and collectively cause material impact to our domestic economy and the U.S. dollar. In due time, we will gain a better understanding of the impact and consequence of each of the foregoing black swan events. In the interim, each of these factors cloud our ability to determine the fate of quantitative easing. As evident from the Federal Reserve's recent open market committee meetings this past Wednesday, the full extent of quantitative easing remains indeterminable. Certainly, our economy has stabilized beyond the economic firestorm of late 2008. The latent impact of monetary actions as quantitative easing will not reflect its success or lack thereof for a while. Today, unemployment remains considerably higher than the desired objectives of quantitative easing. Yet inflation is not an imminent concern, and prices will return to historical levels. Troubling external global developments will interrupt our economy, but its impact cannot be readily determined. Undoubtedly, we need to restore confidence and optimism among our corporate leaders and consumers in order to secure and sustain economic recovery. Abruptly discontinuing quantitative easing or leaving support to undefined market forces is not prudent and potentially counterproductive and destabilizing to our economy. Instead, we need the full cooperation and collaboration of the U.S. Treasury in establishing fiscal policies to encourage investment while simultaneously and carefully reducing our budget deficit. Monetary policy, in and by itself, will not establish nor reestablish economic stability nor restore confidence and optimism. Leaving our economy and financial markets to potentially disruptive factors is too cavalier. Impatience has grown relative to the questionable merits of quantitative easing. Being cavalier and leaving the destiny of our fragile domestic economy to market forces to determine its recovery is suspect. Without continuing support from quantitative easing measures, Treasury yields will increase, as well as the cost of financing. The unforeseen consequences of curtailing quantitative easing are far too significant on today's economy. It is in our best interest to remain supportive of quantitative easing. We're traveling in enigmatic economic times when the adoption of economic measures are untested and results unrealized. In concluding, I'd like to recite a Latin quote, Nulla tenacia invia est, translated. It means for the tenacious, no road is impassable. Thank you for the opportunity to address this critical concern with you. Your time and diligent consideration of quantitative easing has been appreciated, is appreciated. Presentation slides may be accessed on YAM Media website at www.yammedia.biz and the username Commonwealth, password Sensei. At this time, Elizabeth will take questions.
I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio that we're listening to Patrick Yam, who's with us today on the subject of quantitative easing, releveraging of a nation. I'd like to invite questions. If you could come up to the microphone, then we can capture your question as well as the answer.
What bad thing happens to Americans if we default only on the money we owe to the United States Federal Reserve Bank?
We need to understand the fact that our economy is a global economy. We are the leading economy in the world. And basically, any default on our national debt or to the Federal Reserve has got global consequences. Today, we live in a very fragile global economy.
A lot of times, so when they say the percentage of debt to GDP ratio, it's around 62%. You got it at 96. I think it's 96. The difference is that Federal Reserve debt. If it's important to not default, why are we putting out the 62% figure all the time?
Well, you know, once again, it's a matter of the fact that whether or not you read headlines, and headline inflation is certainly different, you know, and much like anything else, I absolutely concur with you. It's more like 96%. And so, yeah. Hi.
Somewhat related area, oftentimes, unfortunately, there's a disconnect between what the preponderance of economists see as the correct and prudent thing to do and what Washington has the courage to do. Mm-hmm. Given that we are coming up on a presidential election year and the posturing has already begun with that, what's your assessment of the current climate of political courage in D.C. to address some of these serious systemic issues that we're facing?
Great question. You know, I look at the fact that we are a nation, okay? We need to collaborate and to unify as citizens. It's not solely the dependency of D.C., albeit the fact that they've been so charged with the responsibility, you know, to legislate on our behalf. We're at a very pivotal time in our economic history, one that we've never seen before, irrespective of what others may have shared with you. Okay, and the thing is, it takes the collaboration and the unification of all of us to be able to best understand how to, you know, secure a better tomorrow.
Patrick, could you address, I mean, we all sort of grew up being taught that, you know, you should save for your future and be, you know, make sure your family finances are stable and so forth. And I think with what was going on in the last 4 or 5 years, many of us have looked at that and said, yes, I will strengthen my savings. Now, that sounds like that's counter to the fact we also should be out there patriotically spending so that we're stimulating the economy. And I've been trying to get a better sense of the balance of those two. What is more of a patriotic duty, number one? And number two, what is happening with the demographics? I mean, many of us are getting close to retirement, so obviously that's going to cause a huge change in our spending, the way we spend. So how do those sort of three things sort of toggle among each other?
Well, Steve, that's a mouthful in itself. That's a great question in itself. Okay. It's the fact that that goes from consumption to pension reformation. And certainly you've heard from me throughout the course of years, there are many challenges and dynamic at that, constantly evolving, that are before us. Okay. It's great to save. We should save. And at the same time, we've got to be mindful of the fact that the consumption rate cannot get back to a point where it was when I was here last, in early part of 2009, when consumption in itself represented 75% of our GDP. Okay? What is the alpha to our economy when that, there are a lot of challenges before. And the thing is that perhaps my speech today is to initiate and provide you with a catalyst, not only thinking about these subjects, but to be proactive, okay? And because there are a lot of subjects before us, and if we remain docile and benign and think that there are leaders, both parties, that have all the answers and are taking all the right measurable steps, well, guess what? Perhaps we're not listening to Plutarch.
Patrick, you present an interesting quandary, which is that we've walked down a road, QE1, QE2, and that the long-term implications of that aren't yet clear. But you also made a statement near the end that it would be cavalier to walk away from that, to step away from it. So the Fed in the FOMC meetings has made a pretty clear indication they're finished, QE2 is done. The presidents of different parts of the Federal Reserve have spoken to that effect over the last month, really, in pretty clear terms. What do you think the roadmap is to unwind it? What's the pace that isn't cavalier?
Eric, thanks. Certainly, I mean, that's a great question from Eric in a sense that, you know, I've talked his ears off about this one for a long time. I don't know if you can unwind it. I seriously don't. I think the thing is that we're in a period that I so define, and most certainly you've heard me phrase this. We're in a period of limbo, okay? And the period of limbo is characterized by the fact that it's a period in which neither do you recognize what's taking place nor foresee what the future will may be. You're in a holding period. You're in a period where you want to be able to best determine what the course may be, and you're hoping that in this foreseeable near term that it's going to define itself. Quite frankly, the magnitude of liquidity that's been injected into our global economies is unbelievable. Perhaps this is the one savior for us, is the fact that we're in a relative parity with everybody else. And so whether the dollar weakens in itself would not be the problem, because everybody else's currency and the strength thereof will weaken. Okay. So in answer to your question, I don't think our trusted leaders know that answer.
Unfortunately, we've come to the point in our program where we have
we'll take one more.
One more question.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Patrick. You covered all the issues, all the pitfalls, all the danger that we have. But with this enormous liquidity that we have, as you just talked about, and also with the importance of the private sector creating jobs, particularly the smaller jobs, smaller industries, why haven't they done it?
Avery, that's a great question. You and I were in investment banking together 35 years ago. And there's a lot, you know, we need to regain confidence and optimism today. I've recited that time and again today. Okay? And the thing is that, pardon me for one moment. Perhaps the one reason why we haven't done it is the fact that up until now, we've looked at the white horse and the person there on the white horse as being solely the Federal Reserve and the inertia created through the injection of liquidity in our system. Well, guess what? Those of you who know me in this audience have heard me time and again talk about the fact that we're members of the same team. This requires as much for the U.S. Treasury and for the enactment of fiscal policy as it does for anything else. Avery, I know specifically, I've chatted with you about the fact that perhaps one of the things that we need to do is somebody's got to take the lead. Perhaps a lead, and not necessarily an answer, but it is an alternative, is to allow for a period of a capital gains holiday. We've got $2.3 trillion on corporate balance sheets in cash. We've got to get the private sector to think about reinvesting in our economy, because if they don't, who will? Okay? Through having a capital gains holiday of, let's say, 3 years, we can then use that as a catalyst to incite economic growth, creation of jobs. And we've got to start somewhere. But the one pejorative issue is the fact that you can't play baseball by having just one team. You have to have both teams involved in this game. Thank you very much.
Again, I want to thank Patrick Yam for his comments here today. Thank you for your provocative comments, Patrick. We also want to thank our audiences at the club as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.